Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com. Go.
Witness. Full Service Radio.
Just some Luke Perry highlight reel some fan made. R.I.P. We lost a real one.
Well, welcome again to the Sun Cinema Podcast, a weekly radio show that examines the highs and lows of the medium of film through the filtered lens of Washington, D.C.'s only privately owned art house cinema. I'm your host, Jason Cauley, and I'm joined as always by my co-host, Ryan Hunter Mitchell and David Cabrera. Gentlemen.
Hi, Jason.
Hi, Dave.
I don't know if anyone was watching. Well, they weren't. I know that they weren't watching, but in here during
you all know the clip. It's
during,
that one.
During that 45 seconds or however long it was, we all just kind of stared at each other like, what is going on? What have we started here?
Well, R.I.P. to Luke.
Well, Perry. We'll play the rest of it at the end because it's just clips from his character Pike in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie with David Arquette also.
Yeah.
I have the pleasure of being able to watch these videos. I knew exactly what was going on.
He's a hunk. Yeah. He's great in it.
Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah, so R.I.P. Dylan McKay.
Yeah. Young death.
One of the cameramen from the Free Solo movie died this weekend, too.
Oh, really? Not Jimmy Chin?
No, I don't. Okay. You know, I don't even want to diss the guy. Like, it's sad, I don't even know which guy it was. He was one of the cameramen.
Those guys were amazing, man. Like, it's just, I highly recommend everyone watch Free Solo as, you know, if you get an opportunity. It's
Andrew
just,
Behrens.
Andrew Behrens, okay.
It was at Air and Space Museum on the IMAX, but it's not there anymore.
Right, right. I could see that almost, if you have any, like, fear of heights, and even people who don't, who just have a natural respect for heights, even on a, you know, home screen, it's pretty intimidating, some of the angles and shots that they got.
I thought this was a part of the Star Wars thing.
Was the best documentary Academy Award winner this year, and it's after seeing it, like, deserved. It's an amazing feat of filmmaking in general. On top of which, you know, the main character, Alex Hannan, I think is how you pronounce his last name. Free climbs, no ropes, no nothing. Bare hands, some grippy shoes, and free climbs 3,200 feet. You almost can't even imagine what 3,200 feet looks like until they show you in this movie. And you're like, they show you at like 400 feet and you're like, oh my God, that's the scariest thing I've ever seen. And they're like, oh yeah, that's 400 feet.
Like, for reference, what is 400 feet tall? I don't know anything.
I mean, 400 feet tall is like a, you know, 35 to 40 story building.
Oh, a very tall building.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's at 400 feet climbing to 3,200
feet. Like El Capitan.
Feet. El Capitan, yeah, in Yosemite, which no one had ever climbed before, you know, as a free solo climb.
Is this where we're headed? We got to start making parkour movies, those crazy Eastern Bloc kids who just, like, take their iPhones and run off a crane.
Right.
50 stories up.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, it's its own whole subculture, obviously, but I mean, like, it just, you can't help but find some kind of newfound respect for just the human capability of doing something like that. It's just insane to watch. I highly recommend seeing it.
Well, we also saw some insane movies this weekend. Yeah, how was Saturday?
Saturday was very fun. We did a screening of the Slumber Party Massacre.
So for people who even have just a reasonable respect for what a knife or a drill right. could do to a human body. Yeah, what were the highlights?
It's a slasher, thrasher. The highlights were the fact that it was one of the most loose screenings, I think, that we've had in a very long time. There was a lot of commentary. I was a little nervous at first. I was like, oh man, people are going to be upset. Then before intermission, some guy came up to the bar. He was like, man, there's like so much commentary. He's like, but I'm not mad.
Right. Like, now, that's the thing. Like, if you get one of those moments, and it has to be the right film, the right crowd, the right night, everything. But like when that happens, like with Sleepaway Camp last year,
yeah.
You know, you just, everybody kind of falls into the same groove and are willing to just kind of ride this out together. And it's magical when that happens. It sounds like that's what happened Saturday night.
Yeah, it was from downstairs, I guess it sounded pretty fun too.
You know, I was downstairs and we could hear every time it would erupt, like it'd be like a group laughter, just screaming, howling, people like stomping their feet. It sounded like
yeah. There's a scene where someone's about to get killed and there's a pizza box and you see them like reach out and someone like yelled out like, "Save the pizza," and that just was like everyone was on board for that. The other highlight,
yeah, some guests came by.
So my uncle is a local musician in D.C. He's great guy. He sent me a message at around 8 saying, "Hey, is the movie full? Like, I want to bring by some friends in town from China." I was like, "Well, it's actually sold out, and the screening is upstairs tonight." I was like, "The movie will be over at like 9:45." Cool. So then at around 9:30, my uncle shows up, walks up the stairs into the screening room slowly.
Which, by the way, most people haven't. When you go upstairs now to the theater upstairs, when you walk in, you're kind of up front.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, you're
not,
right,
you're not
there.
Walking into the back of the theater.
It's,
you're kind of walking,
so it's a
into
little
the front.
Bit more. Well,
yeah, we kept that consistent with downstairs, but right when you walk in, you're almost in front of the screen.
You're out it immediately.
Yeah. It's not, yeah. Not discreet. So
like
long story
people.
Short, he brought 5 people and stumbled towards the back. And
one of which
amongst,
was like 2 or 3 years old. Or something.
She was like 6, I think.
3, whatever. Same.
And you can hear people in the crowd saying like, "Is that a kid?"
Because like, I'm sure people are getting hacked apart on the screen, right?
Yeah, so there's a lot
right
of
at the climax.
There's a lot of boobs and a lot of blood and slashing and thrashing. It was just great. Like, they came to the back of the room, and he just kind of was like, "Hey, what's up, man?" I was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, I was like, "The screen, look." And he was like, "Oh." And, like, so I kept trying to, like, push aside. I was like, "No, you don't."
And wasn't he explaining to his friends?
Yeah, and then finally he was just like, "Yeah, so this is my nephew, and, then, like, this is what he does for a living." And then, like, the movie ended, and he was just, like, kind of standing there, and I'm, like, checking everyone out, and he's like, "I'm going to go downstairs." And then I didn't see him again.
So, before
the... Or the kids.
Or the kids.
Typical slasher movie.
Yeah. Right.
Before they even went up there, they kind of wandered into Suns, and there's, like, you know, 5, 6 people kind of hanging out at the bar, and we had ContraPoints videos on, which are pretty, like, ludicrous-looking videos downstairs. And they kind of came in and just kind of craned their necks, scoped out the room like he was showing them. I just figured it was people from the neighborhood kind of checking out the spot.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that they went up, and that's hilarious.
Yeah, so I should touch base with him and see if he thought that was as funny as I did.
We did Madeline's.
Yeah, how was that?
That movie's, it's so good. Again,
yeah.
Well, probably my favorite movie from last year, just for its approach. Seeing it again, it's still very experimental, but I caught more of the narrative this time and caught how it was building a really cool narrative. It takes the first half of the movie is almost just like abstract. Like, there's definitely some interactions between a daughter and a mother and a theater group, but it's kind of just like a glimmer at someone's life a young teenager, 17-year-old, in New York City and what her life is like. And it's kind of just a montage of her day-to-day.
Right, right.
And that's cool, but it's all, like, the first half is almost just a setup, and then, like, the story kind of happens in the second half.
Yeah.
It was a really good movie. I want to see more of Josephine Decker's stuff. It's definitely real creative and finds a cool way, kind of how Yorgos Lanthimos does, like, just creates a certain, the whole movie is basically to get certain interactions with people that could only be achieved through, like, a weird way of storytelling.
And setting that tone up front and kind of building that universe or whatever that's unique to that film.
Yeah. And then you get a few interactions that are like what the whole movie was made for. It's like, oh, I just want to see these kind of exchanges. And it's a tricky road to get to these kind of communications between the actors and characters. It was really good. It was a full crowd. The crowd was into it. I think we're probably one of the only theaters to show it in DC. So... Yeah. I was psyched on it.
Yeah. Then we did The Hitchhiker on Sunday night, which is an Ida Lupino film. It's the first, like, female-directed noir movie. It was pretty tight. It was pretty, like, straightforward. Only, like, 70 minutes. I'm psyched to see maybe more of their stuff.
I like that inevitably becomes a lens of like how you like movies if you work at a movie theater. It's like, you know, wasn't 3 hours. I like that.
Yeah.
Right.
But she's famous for being in like High Sierra and a bunch of other like old noir. And then she directed a few other things, but Kino Lorber recently just restored this one. But yeah, it was good.
All right. Enough with the pleasantries. Now let's get into the real dirt. Yeah, if you listened to last week's episode, you know we don't even give a shit about the Oscars at all. But we're going to talk about them more because we didn't talk about them enough last week.
There's no contradictions there.
A little different take this time around.
Since then, Spielberg is... So Roma almost won. Everyone probably knows...
I said almost won. It was like the results were close.
It was close. We saw it was neck and neck till the last minute, and Green Book squeaked ahead and took home the best picture.
Painfully.
But there was definitely some... There's a lot of hoopla about a streaming service being a real contender for best picture.
It was, and I mean, yeah, just to kind of reiterate that, I mean, Netflix won as many awards as any other... studio this year.
Four
total, I think. And then, you know, nobody had more than that for a particular film or a particular studio. And a lot of people felt like that momentum was going to carry over to Best Picture. And what ends up happening, again, just to kind of put things in a real quick perspective, is the Best Picture is not voted on by a straight, you know, vote. It's voted by a ranking system. And so you end up with a lot of movies who may get a lot of number one votes, but people in opposition, like Steven Spielberg and the like that we're about to discuss, obviously are putting that at the bottom of the list, and you end up with this aggregate where a film like Green Book kind of sneaks in and wins Best Picture. So that's just to kind of put it into perspective. Now to talk a little bit more about kind of Spielberg and his, you know, plans to move forward with discrediting Netflix as a viable option for the Academy. It's happening.
We've got to stop this.
Yeah, I'll preface all of this with, you know, Jaws is one of my favorite movies of all time. I think it's, you can watch it weekly and it holds up. It's amazing. And he's made so many great films and an amazing filmmaker. I'm not taking anything away from that. But God, if he doesn't come off like a spoiled baby in this whole conversation.
Yeah, well, he's been gearing up since he did like the press junket for Ready Player One.
Right.
Which I don't even know how that movie did. But it shows like where he's throwing his weight.
Right.
And he would kind of trash Netflix just during that press junket. Just kind of like, well, these are TV movies. If you're choosing this medium, you're making a TV movie. Maybe it deserves an Emmy. A lot of these do, but not Oscars. You know? Yeah. So this is before the Oscars even happened.
This was before the Roma and everything else. Uh-huh. Yeah. So and then, all of that happened. And then we had the night we had a couple of weeks ago with, you know, the Oscars. And it really just kind of brought out the ire a little more in Spielberg to the point where he now... plans to ask for an eligibility rules change at the upcoming meeting of the Film Academy's Board of Governors. So that's kind of stoked all kinds of debate, obviously kind of in the Twitter universe and with a lot of independent filmmakers who, frankly, rely on places like Netflix, Amazon, and the like to get their films made.
And so. I'm not even fully knowledgeable about what the criteria are, but I know it's something that these movies have to screen in the L.A. area for a week or two, a certain
2 weeks,
amount of days.
I believe, is the time. Somebody can correct us, call in. You know.
So, obviously, Netflix, they make this great movie, Roma, that you can stream. It does play in a few theaters. It played in D.C., but like clearly they put some money into keeping it in certain theaters in L.A., the whole time, you know, so they Netflix put some money behind this to keep it.
I mean, they ran a real campaign just like, you know, everybody else did with their contenders.
But yeah, I guess it seems like Spielberg's trying to make it even a little harder because some of these streaming sites are getting around the
well, what Netflix does specifically, unlike Amazon, Amazon kind of is kind of excluded in this conversation. And at first I was kind of not understanding why it wasn't equally part of the conversation. The difference is Amazon does do a theatrical release usually 90 days before it's available on streaming. So if you're on Amazon Prime right now, you can go and look and see Cold War's kind of got a place card holder and says available March 22nd.
Yeah, it tricks me every time.
I know. I do it. I've done it a couple of
I've
times.
I've made plans around Cold seeing War. A movie because I'm like, oh, I saw it in my Apple TV search. I'm going to watch that later tonight.
Oh,
and then you make your popcorn and then
rookie mistake. I haven't made that mistake since Amy Winehouse doc did that a while back.
I tried to watch Capernaum this weekend and this happened to me. So I ended up watching Eighth Grade.
There you go. Bo Burnham.
Good, right?
Which was also very good. It was very hard to watch.
Yeah.
Eighth Grade.
Yeah, like because it's so good.
Oh man. Yeah. It just like makes you, it's like a hard movie.
Who wants to relive Eighth Grade?
Sorry for that tangent.
No, but
that works.
It builds into the larger point that it kind of comes to Netflix because what Netflix is famous for doing is releasing in the theater and on the streaming service on the same day.
Yeah,
they just lay it out there and go, hey, this is kind of who we are.
That's what we got.
Unabashedly, and, you know, let's go.
Yeah, and I think it's just a model they've tried. Why not?
Yeah, no, it's effective.
And a couple years ago, maybe it was last year or maybe the year before when ESPN took Best Documentary for the OJ,
right,
which was great. I mean, it was like 9 hours or something. It's so long. But they kept that in a couple theaters and ran it for a few weeks, even though no one was really going in to see it.
Yeah.
But they kind of did that just to qualify.
Right. Yeah.
And it was great. But they weren't kicking up a real storm then because I don't think ESPN is going after their market. But now that it's going for Best Picture, this is
That's it. I mean, it wasn't really a big deal. It was kind of flying under the radar when Netflix was producing less than stellar films, and then you suddenly get Alfonso Cuarón, you know, holy crap, he's going to make a movie, and it turns out to be the most amazing film possibly of the year, or at least on a lot of lists as the best film of the year. It has just kind of reignited Spielberg in this quest to make it ineligible, well, Netflix films ineligible, unless they change how they release their movies to do it the same way that Amazon is. And to Netflix's credit, you know, and they're kind of just playing into this obvious hand that Spielberg's dealing them because he does come off like a spoiled child. And they're just saying, you know, hey, we love cinema, you know. And we just, what did they tweet? They did a Netflix, they did a response to the argument.
So yeah, they clap back, with like their tweet was, we love cinema, here are some things we also love: access for people who can't always afford or live in towns without theaters, letting everyone everywhere enjoy releases at the same time, giving filmmakers more ways to share art. These things are not mutually exclusive.
Right. And I think,
wow, that's awesome.
No, it's great, right? And I mean, I do want to spend just a couple seconds on that. We've got to, you know, kind of follow up charge against Netflix or to Netflix, I guess, but that is kind of the thing. I mean, without Netflix, you're not getting a lot of these small pictures. What ends up happening on a lot of these small films historically, and even more so today, is if they're just coming through the studio system, and they're not getting a lot of support. They're not getting a lot of push and backing. They're going to play for 1, 2, 3 weeks, maybe some small art house film, you know, on a super small screen with limited seating and, you know, not very good sound, not very, you know, not the highest quality of everything, you know, but they don't get the opportunity to then get the exposure like they do on a platform like Netflix. I mean, you know, people have 65, 70 inch televisions at home now. You can sit right there in your living room and have a very theatrical experience when you compare it to some other theaters, even in DC, but especially in New York and LA. And
I can't help but feel like this isn't a dig at Sun Cinema.
No, not in any way. Obviously, that's the best place in DC to see a film, but just for those reasons, because of that intimacy. But I mean, I grew up in the Midwest and grew up before all of this was obviously a point of contention. But I mean, I would drive to St. Louis, you know, 45 minutes away from where I grew up, and have to go seek out these films. And they were always in these small, and I love these theaters, but they were in these small little art house theaters. And they might, I have to get up there on Friday night over that weekend because they're probably next Friday, they're not going to be there.
Yeah.
And
it's exclusive to people. It does exclude people.
It totally excludes people. Yeah. And not to mention, you know, just we're talking about, you know, plopping down $12 to $15, you know, just to get a movie ticket nowadays. I mean, people, especially, you know, young people can't afford to do this. Whereas Netflix and streaming services like them, but specifically Netflix in this conversation anyway, you know, offer this up as, you know, an alternative to what was before a very, you know, limited process of viewing these movies and getting the exposure. If you're the filmmaker and you put 2 years or more of your life into this and all the cast and crew and the money put in to get, you know, maybe a 2 or 3 week run in New York or L.A., it's just exhausting, you know, and then you're going straight to video or streaming anyway. I mean, Netflix kind of circumvents that process and says, hey, we're going to support it. We're going to put it in theaters, but it's also available right here for you to watch at home.
Yeah. You know? Well, here's my read on, I'm using Spielberg's own words here. He's like, you know, Netflix movies, he'd say you're choosing a TV movie medium. You know, they only play in L.A. for a week or two. He's complaining about this. And essentially, they deserve Emmys, but not Oscars. He really wants Oscars to be exclusive. Here's my problem with it, and it reiterates a lot of things you just said. This means that movies would have to follow the current model of making money in the theater, almost exclusively.
Right.
Never mind that Spielberg movies, big George Lucas movies make a ton of money in merchandising and all these other things.
For sure.
Those are all fine, you know, but essentially the movies have to... He wants them to be able to make their money in the theater. And that model is disappearing.
The model is gone. It's not disappearing. Yeah, it's gone.
Yeah.
I mean, some suckers like us are starting a little, you know, tiny room theater, which we try to deliver a certain experience. But other places are just giving these big comfy seats with the delivery, fast food, and for $15-16 a ticket. You know, okay, that's them clinging to try to make this continue to work for a while.
Right.
The multiplex theater experience. But what he's not bringing up, he's not making this argument using his platform to push back against low quality, like mind-numbing spectacles that litter multiplexes. He isn't even arguing that the quality of the acting or filmmaking or cinematography is bad in these Netflix things. He's literally just complaining that it isn't the same economic model of filmmaking. It needs, like...
Right.
If you have to fill the theater, okay, cool. The only movies that we're going to do this, we figured out, are Marvel movies. And like for a couple weeks, you can run a Bradley Cooper movie, Melissa McCarthy movie. And these are all fine. Like, I like the Marvel movies. But you can either like read the room and start changing and start directing at a smaller budget or in a different platform that doesn't have all these expenses that multiplexes do. Or you could just make the seats bigger.
Right. Well, and I mean, I would go on further to say this always, you know, kind of makes me angry anyway when anyone does this. But you're bringing a problem, you know, that you've surmised on your, you know, by yourself or with a handful of other directors, Christopher Nolan, who has actually backtracked on his statement a little bit already.
Oh, they're all going to do it eventually. Spielberg's going to do a Netflix movie one day.
Yeah, or some version of whatever Netflix is in 15 years. But yeah, I mean, the point is, like, you're not bringing any solutions to this argument. You're not Spielberg going, hey, we have a problem. You know, I want these to be, I want to save the cinema experience. I want to save theater. These are all things most of us can get behind. I love the cinema experience. I love sitting in a dark room looking at a large screen with, you know, 200 strangers. It provides a unique experience that you don't get at home.
Definitely.
It's true. That said, he's not saying, hey, what I'm going to do to help solve this problem is I'm going to start supporting smaller films. Uh-huh. I'm going to start producing smaller films and giving them the push and the support that they need to be, you know, given wide releases so that the Alfonso Cuarons, I mean, Alfonso Cuarón, this guy already owned an Oscar, you know, I mean, like, he couldn't get this done. Martin Scorsese's making a Netflix movie right now to be released this fall for Oscar contention because he couldn't get it made at Paramount because they balked. This is Martin fucking Scorsese.
Yeah, okay? Some people are making the decision to, like, just, like, all right,
Jack,
hey,
did you get that sound bit?
Well,
we're gonna need that.
Right,
my,
though.
My point is, if Martin Scorsese's going to Netflix because he can't get a movie made at Paramount, where does that leave virtually every other filmmaker?
Yeah.
In the same exact boat, where you've got to look for alternative ways to get your stuff produced and out there.
Yeah. What if no one would have funded Ready Player One? Like, the world would... Who knows what the world would be like if no one had funded Ready Player One for Spielberg? Right?
Yeah.
I was going to say, I do, because I've never seen that.
No, I don't think anyone's seen the movie. I think it bombed. Like, he's even bombing on his big budget things.
I also think that, like, if your argument is to, you know, uphold an institution in general, right? Which I kind of feel like...
The Oscars.
Right, which in general, sort of the conversation we've been having the last couple of weeks is about the Oscars and their relevance and how... Things are changing, and like
the entire theater experience.
Do Oscars even fucking matter anymore? I don't know. You know, like,
did they ever?
Yeah. But if your argument is to uphold an institution, then it would seem that the impetus is on you to explain why the institution as it is is better.
Still valid.
Yeah, is valid or better than, you know. And here we are, like, talking about there are some real reasons that maybe things are better if it changes, you know, or like. So yeah, that's all.
No. I mean, those are all fair points. That's kind of the crux of the conversation is, you know, it just comes across as someone who is completely out of touch on every level with the way cinema is changing, the way we are consuming media and film and other art, the absolute and complete, you know, lack of acknowledgement that female directors don't get the exposure. You know, minorities don't get the exposure. There's, I mean, we're not even talking about, like, age discrimination, which happens to white people as well. You know, I mean, like, all of these things are factors that can find an audience and with a place like Netflix or Amazon or these other streaming services that don't have that opportunity anymore in the standard studio system or the standard cinema experience. I mean, the real people behind the majority of this push are the theater owners, you know?
And it's not that they're unaware of all these things. They're
no,
not,
of course.
They're not stupid. They just know that it protects their model. They're like, Spielberg's like, hey, listen, my movies get made. I don't want to be having to contend with all this other stuff for the Oscars. He wants it for him. He wants to keep it in the club. And that's what all of this is about. It's just keeping... And I do want to push back a little bit on the Netflix thing, even though I think their response is great. Like, if we look at it, you know, we love cinema. Here's some other things we love. Access for people who can't afford movie theaters, don't live next to the towns. That's great. Letting everyone everywhere release at the same day, blah, blah, blah. These are great. Giving filmmakers more ways to share art. I fully stand by each of these things. I think they're getting an easy pass and no scrutiny on it because... Spielberg's being a total jackass.
He's making himself an easy villain, right?
And Netflix is way better at this, but, you know, it's not altruism. You know, they've got their own reasons they're doing everything. Sure. I don't know that they're necessarily trying to further art in any more reason than it might make them some money. I mean, they're still thinking money and all this, but it does get to a certain core idea about creating art or creating movies or anything. It's like, why are we doing it? Shouldn't it be that we can reach more people, we can be more creative, and it's not so exclusive to classist ideas or geographical locations? That's a good emphasis to put, like, moving forward. Like, why are we making movies? And I think Spielberg should be thinking about that same thing, because those are things that are hard to respond to.
Right. And I feel like what you just read off the tweet from Netflix and their response to Spielberg is like a great start to that conversation.
Yeah.
Right. Like, but the next phase is kind of what you just said.
Yeah. Well, it's like, oh, it's enjoyable to everyone at the same time. It's like, yeah, if you have the next Netflix password.
Sure, sure.
But these are all fine if it helps create good art.
And I think all those things are comparable. I mean, the reason I love cinema above every other art form is because cinema has, from almost day one, never excluded commerce from the conversation that it has with art.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other art forms try to live down kind of their artistic or their financial support and make it seem like this is all born out of inspiration and it just kind of, you know, happened. Cinema is very upfront about, like, we need money to make this movie.
Definitely.
It costs a lot of fucking money and we need to support the artists who are going to make these films. That can be part of the conversation.
Totally.
And you can put that into perspective if you're Netflix and say, hey, look, yeah, obviously we're here to make money. We have a subscription service. Mm-hmm. It's 150 million people strong worldwide. We're obviously doing some things right. And because we're able to do this and provide that service at $12 a month or whatever it is for the streaming service, you know, it allows us to support smaller films, smaller, you know, less observed filmmakers and people who don't necessarily have the opportunities in a studio system to make the films they want.
I think it also shows something else, that not only does it give them the ability to let a more diverse amount of people into the filmmaking process, more creative work, younger work that isn't getting any studio money. Not only does it allow for them to fund those things and help distribute those things, I think their model also shows that there's a want for it.
Right.
Which the studio system and the movie theater system, you know, structure doesn't really have. Like, sometimes they'll make black movies, or they'll make a chick flick. They'll make certain movies, but they still have to fill a theater and make money that way.
Right.
I think Netflix is noticing that actually, like, more subtle work can be made, and there's a big need for it. People do want it. And I think it's not just that they're trying to be good and have 20% of their Netflix-produced stuff be made by women. I think they also notice that that is better, and in this more democratized medium, there's a need for it.
Right.
So I think that's showing that that the model, people want it,
yeah,
and they're just reading it and making it for everyone. They're just distributing stuff that people want.
Yeah. I mean, it reads like a lot of things where, you know, people with power are surrounded with people who have ideas that aren't necessarily the ideas of what most people are thinking. You know, it's like, you know, they're surrounded by these people who are like, oh, this has worked before, let's do this, as opposed to, like, I mean, that's more of like the Hollywood model, right?
Sure. And
whereas, you know, Netflix is like, you know, recognizing the changes and is more in tune with what's going on in the world, and so.
I think they certainly are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, and Mark Rudolph, the founder of CEO, give us a call. We're obviously, you know, capable of running your entire PR setup right now.
Yeah, at least free subscriptions or something.
Right. Yeah. Could you hook us up? But no, I mean, I think, like you said, it's easy to villainize Spielberg in this because he's completely wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, he really is. You're attacking something that 150 million people disagree with you on.
Yeah.
You know, that have said, no, we kind of like this. This is kind of the way we're headed. And, you know, for Netflix to take the high road, great. Could they kind of take the next step and make some other, you know, make this conversation even bigger and stronger in their favor? Absolutely.
Oh, definitely.
But, I mean, make no mistake, they can stand by their own numbers. I mean,
yeah.
Ava DuVernay had a great, like, tweet that she had put out that was like, oh, let me see if I can find it. It's One of the things that I value about Netflix is it distributes black work far and wide. Like, that's a thing that
right.
Paramount isn't doing, or, you know,
or any other studio.
Anyone right. else, yeah.
I mean, yeah, this is...
Like, Netflix is actually putting stuff out there.
Well, and they're putting stuff out there and with, you know, a diversity that just hasn't been equaled in the rest of the entire Hollywood system. Right now, all films, 88% of all films are male-directed in the studio system or outside of the kind of Netflix world. In Netflix, it's 27%. It's more than double.
Big improvement.
Yeah. Is it 50-50? Absolutely not.
Sure.
We can have, you know, a larger debate about that, but... Two things. One, things are changing, you know, in that direction positively for female directors and female filmmakers across the board. And places like Netflix are leading the charge.
Yeah.
Not the studio system, who's holding on to kind of these antiquated ideas and you know, just kind of a stubborn business model that's refusing to change. It's almost... They're like big oil at this point.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, we know solar and electric, you know, is really much better for everybody. And we could totally, you know, the entire world could live benefit. Off of this system.
Yeah.
And be far better off. But that's not our business model. But so screw all money. Of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. And that's kind of, I mean, the studio system isn't coming back with, hey, you know what we're going to do? Here's how we're going to answer this problem. They're not. Capable of doing that. It's a broken system.
No, they're like, we're gonna make a Fleetwood Mac documentary or a biopic next year. That's their response.
Like Remy or Rami, what's the guy's name?
Oscar winner Remy Malek.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
No, it's gonna be like Amanda Bynes is gonna come back and fucking clean up next year at the Oscars in this Fleetwood Mac doc biopic, whatever. Should we breeze through March? We just put out a new calendar.
Did we talk about March last week or no?
No, we didn't. Let's just read through it.
Yeah. So we're doing a month of predominantly female-directed movies. Some
how progressive of you.
Yeah.
You know, we pat ourselves
that,
on the
Hollywood,
back.
Take that, Spielberg.
Yeah, dude, get with it. We just did like a couple days ago.
And also some other like, you know, Svetlana of BYT, the BYT Murder Club is doing a Killer Femmes series, for instance. That's going to be Sisters, Alice Sweet Alice, and Audition. We've got a bunch of stuff from 2018, Madeline to Madeline we showed, Skate Kitchen, The Rider, I Am Not a Witch. Doing a horror series, all female directed on Saturdays, Slumber Party Massacre we talked about, Pet Cemetery,
yeah.
Near Dark, Ravenous, and The Babadook.
It's a good lineup.
It's a good series, yeah.
It really is. Good
lineup. And then we've got some docs. One that I'm really excited about is Portrait of Jason. It's Shelley Clark who did
Shirley Clark, who did the
Connection.
Mm-hmm.
And then doing some like art house classics on Sundays. The Hitchhiker. We talked about Seven Beauties is a Lena Wittmuller film. She did Love and Anarchy and Swept Away.
She was also the first female director ever nominated.
Yeah.
You got Catherine
Four
Bigelow,
Seven
the
Beauties,
other,
right?
The other, Four Seven Beauties or Swept Away?
Seven Beauties was nominated for like four
Best
Oscars.
Best Picture, I think.
Yeah.
Right?
An Angel at My Table is a Jane Campion movie. Rat Catcher is Lynn Ramsey, who also did Joaquin Phoenix one that came out
last year. Did like that a lot.
You were never really here. Rat Catcher is a pretty bleak but beautiful movie, or like I think it's her debut. And then The Scarlet Empress is not directed by a female. It's Joseph von Sternberg or whatever, but it's a Marlena Dietrich movie that's really cool. I saw it at Music Box in Chicago. And
Very
it was like
cool.
snowing out, and I was like, "This is cool, man." Yeah, that's about it. We've got Baby Alcatraz, a good friend of ours, Alyssa, who's a DJ, who's going to be presenting maybe some music videos and some.
And you got Gleaners and I.
Gleaners and I, that's and that's an Agnes Varda movie.
It's about like foragers, right, or scavengers?
Yeah, and that one is presented with Fake Fruit Factory, which is a Chick Strand short. And that one is going to be presented by Giovanna Chesler, or G6 Pictures. And Giovanna is the, I think, is the head of the film program at George Mason.
Hmm.
Yeah. And then we're also doing this one night at the end of the month. It's a film called Losing Ground, which is part of Milestone Films. It's, you know, I'm going to slaughter this one. Doesn't matter. There's a lot of connection between the L.A. Rebellion movement of black filmmakers. But it's being presented by Nzinga Kendall, who is part of this black film archive, or was part of this black film archive at Indiana University.
Cool.
And there might be a short presented with that as well. We're going to figure that out like tomorrow. But yeah, that's...
And then Daisies.
And Daisies. We threw in Daisies at the end of the month because it's just...
It kills.
So fun. Have you seen Daisies?
Have I seen Daisies?
Yeah.
Am I...
It's a Czech New Wave one that's like... You've probably seen clips from it in the background. It's real psychedelic and it's real fun.
Really cool editing. Yeah. Two female protagonists. They're...
Yeah.
Oh,
and it's like
good.
Late 60s, you know, it's like 68 or 66, I think.
66.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things that I had seen in the background a lot. And then I don't know if I had sat through and watched it by like all in one sitting, but when we screened it, it was very well received.
Czechoslovakian film.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't seen this for some reason.
Czech New Wave.
Cool.
Check.
I'm down.
You should check it out.
We're just getting into our groove right now.
Yeah, exactly. Check it out.
Totally side note from everything. I just watched Holy Mountain again.
Of course you did.
So good.
Yeah.
Everyone should watch that regularly.
That and Jaws weekly and watch.
Jaws.
No, but now on like the fifth, sixth time of watching Holy Mountain, it makes more and more sense each time.
Mm.
Like as a actual, I'm more in tune with like the linear progress of the movie.
I think I need to watch it a few more times too.
It's just like, I think it's all just critiquing like the human want for transcendence.
Got it.
How it's a joke and all the different ways we treat it. It's a cool way of... He critiques so much in it. There's so much imagery I can never keep up.
Right, yeah.
But using that lens of just like, these are all things that we try to achieve transcendence or some immortality.
Yeah.
Is a fun way of looking at it. And you feel like you're on acid.
Yeah.
For days.
Yeah.
And I am on acid.
Has that effect.
And we're actually all on acid.
For days.
For days.
For daisies. Should we just close out with that highlight reel of Luke Perry?
Yes.
I think there's some audio on. Now there's actually Luke Perry talking.
Can you start it with a little bit of the music again?
Just no, it plays more
anxiety.
It plays mood music throughout the whole thing. Don't worry.
Oh, good.
It keeps building.
It's beautiful.
Damn. 28 days later.
Oh, I love this scene.
So good in that.
Girls.